There we go. Once I screen share, it's harder to find the recording button. They hide everything. All the menus get truncated and smaller, but I think we're in business now. So good morning. It is now 9 a.m. Thursday, January 28th, and we're doing Chem12BL, and this morning we're going to talk the Grignard reaction. So the idea behind this lecture, the goal of this lecture, is to explain the reaction and explain just like we would in a lab lecture if we were getting ready to do this lab. That's the content that I sort of want to give you. And so let's look at the reaction, first of all, that we're going to be doing and talk about the reaction a little bit. So this is a Grignard reaction. It is experiment. Oh, I didn't write that down. I think it's like, nope, can't remember. It'll come back to me in a little bit. We'll get exactly what experiment it is. In Pavia, there are two parts. There's an A part and a B part. And we are doing just the A part. So we are looking at taking bromobenzene. And in the first step of this reaction, we react it with magnesium metal, and we do it in diethyl ether. So remember that abbreviation, ET2O. This is diethyl ether. And the abbreviation is sort of showing the two ethyl groups flanked on either side of the oxygen. The magnesium oxidatively inserts, that's the phrase that we use for what type of reaction mechanism this is, oxidative insertion. Oxidatively inserts in between the bromine and carbon bond. And so what we create there is we get a magnesium, which is a 2+, a bromine, which is a minus. And then the carbon technically has a negative charge on it as well. And then in the second step, we take this and in the same reaction vessel, we don't actually isolate the Grignard. All we do is take the same reaction vessel and we add to it a solution of benzophenone, which is going to be our electrophile. This is also done in diethyl ether. And then this is a two-step process. So I'm going to slide this over just a little bit, and I think I'll probably do the two steps here and then show you how we combine them and write them into one step. So the first thing that winds up happening is this negative charge attacks the carbon here, breaking this bond, moving the electrons up onto the oxygen. And so what we create is something that now has three benzene rings on it. And the oxygen now has a negative charge and is coupled with the magnesium, which is 2+, and the bromide, which is minus, in a complex ion. And then from there, after that part, we have an acidification and an acid workup step. So we add 6 molar hydrochloric acid. And that 6 molar hydrochloric acid then protonates the oxygen. And we wind up with the actual product, which is triphenylmethanol. This molecule, triphenylmethanol, also has another name. So if you look it up, if you were to go into the Merck Index or if you were to look it up online, triphenylcarbinol is the other name for it. So it can go by either name. Triphenylmethanol is the more common name that it goes by. But if you look it up systematically, it is oftentimes referred to as triphenylcarbinol. And so what we have done is we've taken this carbanion, this piece here, and created a new carbon-carbon bond. Into that triphenylmethanol. Okay, so that's the overall reaction. That's what we're doing. And the devil is sort of in the details of how do we actually go through and do this reaction and how do we put everything together. So in order to understand why we do certain things, we need to understand the nature of that Grignard reagent. And we talked about that on Tuesday a little bit. We talked about how the Grignard reagent is both an extremely good nucleophile, but also an extremely strong base. And so it's that base property that makes the Grignard reagent really difficult to deal with. So if we start to look at that base property, what we had said was that this Grignard reagent, being a strong base, easily grabs protons from any acidic source that it can find. And one of the things that it tends to find fairly easily, particularly in this type of weather, is water vapor. That negative charge will grab a proton and it will destroy the Grignard reagent, creating benzene and essentially magnesium hydroxide as a complex ion with hydroxide, magnesium ion, and also the bromide ion. And so everything has to be scrupulously dry. Everything, the water, all the solvents have to have the water dried out of them. The glassware has to be dried. All the equipment that we handle, everything has to be dried. Everything has to have very careful removal of water in order for this reaction to be successful. So when we go and use diethyl ether, as a solvent is very, very prone to picking up water. It's hygroscopic. And it does that because of its ability to hydrogen bond. And so more so than many other solvents, diethyl ether sucks up water like crazy. So what we tend to use is we use anhydrous diethyl ether. This is ether that is comes in a special container. It has a lid on it that is a lot like a bottle cap, like you would see on a beer bottle, that is sandwiched over the top of it. And in the center of that bottle cap is a rubber septa. And that component, that rubber septa, allows you to go in and out of the bottle with a needle. And if you backfill it with nitrogen, then no water can get into the bottle. Now, what we typically do is we typically take that bottle cap off and we add to it a bunch of little clay spheres called molecular sieves. These are little water sponges. They soak up water and they prevent any water from accumulating, or any water that gets into the diethyl ether, from students opening the bottle and going in with a pipette as long as we keep the bottle closed up tight after everybody goes in and out of it, those molecular sieves help to dry the reagent and keep it dry so that water doesn't accumulate within it every time we take the lid on and off of the container. So that's part of how we keep everything dry. With the glassware is a special problem too. So the glassware has to be kept dry. And if you think about, and I said this to the afternoon class, I don't think I talked about it as much with the morning class, but when we look at glassware, things like round bottom flasks or any sort of glassware, the glassware is made up of repeating elements of silicon and oxygen in the silicon dioxide, right? And so we have these polymers of silicon and oxygen, and the lone pairs on the oxygen will hydrogen bond to water as well, meaning that glass is very hydrophilic. And water adheres to glassware very strongly. So what we typically do is we typically take all of the glassware and we place it into an oven. And we have these sort of glassware ovens that we use for drying things, much like you may have used, well, you probably didn't because you were in Chem 1B when COVID started. Sometimes there's certain things that we use these ovens for Chem 1B. They have racks inside them. They have an opening at the top and they have a thermometer that comes out the top of it so that we can see what the temperature is inside the oven. And we normally take and set this guy at about 110 degrees to 115, somewhere in that range. And we put the glassware inside that oven and we bake the glassware for 24 hours. And then when the glassware comes out, it comes out hot, it comes out dry. And our goal is to then assemble all of that glassware while it is still hot, such that water vapor cannot condense on it. Mary, thank you, experiment 33. So this is 33A. Is what we're looking at. Oop. Cascade failure there. Fortunately, this application reboots super fast when it does decide to crash. Okay. So we dry all of the glassware. So the reagents are dried. Chemically, these are all of our solvents and starting materials. And then the glassware is dried in the oven for a minimum of 24 hours. Sometimes if we have to restart and we need extra glassware and we don't have enough glassware in the oven because we've just taken enough for what students need and put it into the oven because we're pulling this out of your chemical lockers. If we need to reset, we can wash a piece of glassware and then we can actually dry that glassware as we need it. And one way to dry that glassware is to take and wash the glassware really well. And then what we do is we take, for instance, the round bottom, and we dry it using a Bunsen burner, and we flame dry it. And we heat this thing really well, and we hold it with a pair of tongs. And we rotate it around. You can see that as you start to dry it, what's really interesting is the minute that the flame hits the glassware, all of the water goes up and hits up on the top side up here. And you'll see this fog that happens on the top side of the glass because the top side of the glass acts like a condenser. And so you'll see almost like a bathroom mirror after you get out of the shower where you see the steam on the bathroom mirror, you can or the condensation on the bathroom mirror, you can see that condensation happen on the top of the glassware. And so what we do is we carefully rotate this thing so that we heat all sides of the glassware until we get all that condensation off. And then we set it down, and because it gets way hotter than 115, this glassware can easily reach 200 degrees. We set it down and let it cool a little while before we pick it up and try to work with it. So we're careful after we do that sort of flame drying. So that's another way that we can go through and prepare our glassware. All right, so the glassware that we're going to need, the equipment that we get set up for this, where did I do that? Here we go. So this is the equipment that we generally set up for the reaction. So we start off with a 25 mil round bottom flask. The other piece that is here, this is called a Claisen. Usually we say a Claisen adapter, but it can be just referred to as a Claisen. This piece here is a drying tube. And then we've got a 5 mil conical vial and the Erlenmeyer flask. And we usually use 25 mil for this as well. The other pieces that are here, this guy is a number one rubber stopper with a hole in it. And this piece is a rubber septum. The calcium chloride beads that are listed over here. So these guys, at this point, we usually store these in your lockers with a good tight fitting lid on them. These are a desiccant material, a drying material. They're extremely hygroscopic. If you take one of these calcium chloride beads, you set it on the table, within 5 minutes, you no longer have a bead, you have a puddle of water. It basically sucks up so much water that it dissolves itself and becomes a puddle of water. And so when these spill, you need to clean them up really fast because they start getting super sticky and they start just turning into little drops and puddles of water all over your desktop within 5 minutes, particularly in this type of weather. So this is a drying agent.
And that's the drying agent that you said we would use earlier.
Mm-hmm. No, these guys here that we talk about, they look very similar to the calcium chloride beads. The calcium chloride beads are white. These guys are a clay material. So these are a porous sort of clay. I can't spell that word. I'm horrible at spelling. Been horrible at spelling all my life. If I haven't memorized a word, I can't spell it. It's just the way it goes. So we deal with it. So these guys are a clay material. They will not dissolve. And the pores that are in them are appropriately sized to allow water molecules to be able to enter those pores, but they don't really accept larger molecules. So really all they do is they suck up water and that's their sole job. And they stay solid and rigid and they can be hazed out just as solid waste later on. So once they get saturated, then they're no longer useful. So they're only useful as long as they're sucking up small amounts of water. These guys are slow, slow at absorbing water. But they have a fairly high capacity to absorb water. The calcium chloride is a very fast drying agent, sucks up water super quickly. And one of the reasons that we use these clay beads inside something like a solvent like this is because they don't dissolve, because they're inert. And so they don't contaminate porous. Thank you, JC. They don't contaminate the solvents and the reagents that we're using. Unlike calcium chloride, calcium chloride could dissolve to a degree if we were to put it into diethyl ether and would constitute a contaminant that could enter into our reaction. The way that we're going to use these beads is that no chemicals are going to come in contact with them. We are going to put them into the drying tube that is going to allow air to pass through it to dry the air that is going into the reaction more than to dry the chemicals that are in the reaction. So we'll see as we assemble it, how we go through and put all these things together. Okay, we tend to use a 3 mL syringe. This is a lure lock syringe, and we use a 22 gauge needle. Needles are tracked in gauges with the smaller the number, the bigger the size of the metal. So as you go from a 22 gauge to an 18 gauge, an 18 gauge is a really big needle. A 22 gauge is a pretty small, fine needle. And this little piece that I have underneath it is a cover for the needle. That cover serves two purposes. It usually fits over the needle itself, and then it helps in assisting to screw the needle onto the syringe body. And it also protects you so that you don't stab yourself when you're working with it. And then we just remove that little plastic cover when we're ready to work. A micro spatula. And then the long stem pasture pipettes. That's pretty much what we need glassware wise. And all of the glassware fits within, all of this glassware comes out of your locker. So this is all equipment that you would have had. And this last little part over here that I didn't show, these little guys here, this is a cap and O-ring. And that cap and O-ring, you have multiple caps and O-rings in your locker. The cap and O-ring fits on all of these pieces. All of these pieces are threaded, and it allows for that cap and O-ring to join these together. And I'll show how that system works and how we kind of join it together. And I go through this, hopefully I'll do this enough in the video too, when you see the video. I was gonna try and go in yesterday and film it all. The weather was just not conducive to doing that. So I'm gonna film it on Friday. I'll film it tomorrow and we'll see how that all goes. Okay, so what we do in sequence is the first thing is we pull this drying tube out of the oven and we get the drying tube all set up. So in sequence of things that we're going to do is procedure. Set up drying tube. To do that, we grab this guy out of the oven. We're gonna need that rubber stopper. And we're gonna need the calcium chloride beads. And we use a little bit of cotton. So this is a cotton ball that we grab from a reagent area. And what we do is we take that drying tube and we put a small piece of cotton in it, not a great big piece. But the idea is that we want to sort of plug the bottom of this thing. So the first thing that goes in, it's just a little bit of that cotton ball that sets in there. And then we fill it about 3/4 full with these calcium chloride beads. Doesn't have to get filled up to the top. And then we jam this rubber stopper onto the bottom of it. And actually, I had sized this, so I'm just going to grab this guy. And it doesn't go all the way through the stopper. It goes about midway through the stopper. If you try to jam it all the way through the stopper winds up getting too wide at the bottom, and then it won't fit onto the glassware in the way that we need to actually build it. And we're very careful not to cap this. Sometimes students feel like they need to cap everything and close everything up, and they get this idea that we're protecting everything from water, and in protecting it from water, errors have happened. We'll talk about that. And Keegan, yes, looks expensive. The glassware that you use in OChem is very different from the glassware that you would have used in Chem 1A or Chem 1B. All of these pieces of glassware, the round bottoms are probably about $25 a piece. The darn conical vials, those 5 mil conical vials are, oh, and I didn't put a name on this guy. The conical vials are like $30 a piece. So all the glassware is very expensive that we work with. Okay, so we got this drying tube set up. And you do that while it's still warm. You don't wait for this thing to cool down. You actually don't want any water condensing onto the glassware. So we're pretty careful to work expeditiously while the glassware is still warm. And that means that you're kind of juggling some hot glassware. You're trying to be a little bit careful as you're working with it. And at the same time, trying not to spill the calcium chloride beads. One of the ways that we get the calcium chloride beads in there, everybody starts looking for funnels and where do I get a funnel? We tend not to use funnels. In fact, most of the time when I see you trying to use a funnel, I take it away from you and throw it away. Funnels just lead to a lot of trouble a lot of times. So what I do is take a piece of weighing paper and fold it corner to corner. And then once that weighing paper is folded, what you do is you sort of use it like a funnel in a way, but something that's a little bit easier to use. And we shoot the beads into here, and it's fairly easy to take in and to put the beads into that piece of paper, cup it in one hand and guide it into the glassware with the other hand so that the beads all go where you want them to go. So that's how we get them all in there. Okay, the next thing that we do in setting this up is we start to assemble assemble jack stand, clamps, stirrer hot plate, and you get this all set up first. So this, the jack stands are a way of raising and lowering equipment, and they have a couple of metal plates with a scissors jack in between them. Not my best drawing. I'm going to leave off the bottom plate because that's just going to make it a little bit easier and clearer. And these guys have a handle out here that has a little dial that you turn to be able to jack this thing up and down. And then we take and we place a hot plate on top of this. And a ring stand. And we'll have a couple of clamps that'll come out off of this ring stand. Once that's all in place, then what we do is we take and we bring the glassware out and we start assembling the glassware. So we want to do this fairly quickly while the glassware is still hot. And essentially what we wind up doing, let me go back and see what I'm going to need. I'm going to need the round bottom flask. I'm going to need this O-ring and drying cap, the Claisen. I'll catch the drying tube from where we built it already. And what we do is we take and we put this cap on first. The cap sits on the Claisen in that position. And then the O-ring comes in here and goes on after the cap. The O-ring's job is to sit on that little ledge that's right there so that when the cap drops down over the O-ring keeps the cap from falling off. And that's what locks it in. If you forget that little O-ring, bad things happen. The round bottom, once we hook these two together, that that O-ring, if it's not in there, will just allow the cap to slide off and the whole round bottom will drop off and break as you're trying to hold everything and clamp everything together. So you need to get that O-ring in there for sure. Okay, so then these guys get hooked together. Oh, and I'm already forgetting something that I need to do. I should have had magnesium already weighed out, but we'll get there in a minute. So we've got our little O-ring in there. We've got a little cap that fits over this. And this guy is assembled. We throw in a magnetic spin vane, which I didn't have in my diagram. And then to this, we add our drying tube. The drying tube fits into this piece right here and sits fairly tightly with that rubber stopper. And then the rubber septa goes in this position and turns and fits tightly over the outside. And then that whole thing winds up getting set up. Let me see if I can find, I had, a drawing at some point. Oh, you know what? It's not in here. It's in Chem 3. And I was just looking at it this morning. I meant to grab it and I should have grabbed it and pasted it in. Maybe I'm just going to ignore it because I can't find it. That's all right. We'll just redraw it. Sometimes I like to reuse drawings if I can, instead of having to redraw everything from scratch. But this whole thing gets set up and centered essentially on the hot plate. That hot plate has two dials on it, one for spinning and one for heat. This whole thing is sitting on top of that jack stand. The jack stand is slightly elevated and clamping off the ring stand occurs in two strategic places. We like to set a clamp at the top of the drying tube to hold all of that in place. And we like to set a clamp here on the Claisen, not on the round bottom itself, but on the Claisen, because we want to be able to remove the round bottom as we need to be able to do certain types of manipulations as the reaction is going. And if you clamp on the round bottom, then you have to undo the clamps and undo everything, and everything starts to become very rickety if you try to undo that. So we clamp on the Claisen and we clamp on the drying tube. Okay, once that's all set up, now what happens is, as the glassware dries, not dries, as the glassware cools, as it's cooling down, the air temperature inside the glassware is also cooling down. And if you think about what happens with heat, the air mass starts to contract and take up less volume. That draws fresh air into the apparatus. But as that fresh air comes into the apparatus, air that is entering here, which is wet, moist air, as it comes through and it comes and gets pulled down into here, it becomes dry air. And that calcium chloride acts to dry the air. And that's what we want, that as this glassware is cooling down and drawing air into it, as the air mass cools, we want only dry air to be able to come into here. And that's why we assemble this thing while it's hot, so that as it cools down, all of the air that it draws into it will be dry air, and then no moisture can get into the setup. At that point, the setup is solid and no more water vapor can get into the setup. Does that make sense? And if there's any questions as we're going through these, please just let me know. And I'll explain in a little bit more detail. Now, at this point, I would have also weighed out my magnesium and entered my magnesium into it, but we're going to go ahead and do it at this point. So,
I have a question.
Go for it.
I'm just wondering about the CaCl2 like beads.
Yeah.
Do they not dissolve in the tube? Like, because you were saying that when they're out in open air, that like very quickly they turn into water. Does that not affect like the system of the experiment?
Okay, so that's a great question. When a magnesium or calcium chloride bead falls on the table, it is isolated as a single bead. That single bead starts to suck up water from the environment and can suck up so much water that, like I said, in about 5 minutes, it can turn into a puddle. But it's soaking up water from everywhere, and it has no constraints on how much water it can absorb. What happens here is that this calcium chloride is inside a restricted narrow opening, and all the rest of the calcium chloride down here has immense capacity. So yes, the top beads do start to get a little bit glassy and sticky, but the rest of this calcium chloride, the water starts to sort of be distributed through it in a way that it can't suck up enough water to actually turn itself into a puddle. If we don't cap this and we left this out for 24 hours or 48 hours, eventually all this calcium chloride turns into a solid mass from the amount of water that winds up getting absorbed into it. But we're not going to be doing the reaction that long. And so for the time frame over which we use it, this material stays free flowing and powdery, and doesn't actually soak up enough water to cause it to become a solid mass or even a puddle. So yeah, that's a great question. We just don't have that much air movement in and out of this to create that. It's not as if we have a fan that is drawing air through this at a constant rate, soaking up tons of water. Once the air mass sort of moves into it and the glassware cools, the air movement sort of stops and the whole system stays dry. Yeah, excellent question. Okay, so we're going to weigh out 0.15 grams of magnesium. And we tend to use magnesium turnings, and this is an approximate value. It doesn't have to be dead on. The magnesium turnings themselves are really fairly small, and they look like sort of a little spiral, and they have an edge to them. And these magnesium turnings, are, well, I'll get to that in a minute. We'll talk about that in a minute. Let's just weigh out these magnesium turnings. So what we do is we use a piece of weighing paper. We fold it corner to corner, just like we would have before. And we have our approximate 0.15 grams of magnesium that's on there. That magnesium, then, we're going to briefly open the container, the apparatus, and we're going to add the magnesium. And there's several places where that could happen. We could either remove the septa up here momentarily and drop the magnesium in through the straight tube, or you can release the round bottom, drop the magnesium in, and then reconnect everything fairly quickly.
Do we have to do anything extra to make sure the magnesium is dry?
No, although that's a good question. We have another problem with the magnesium. This is what I was going to talk about a little bit later, but we could do it here. The magnesium, when you look at it, if we were to take a cross section of the magnesium on all sides has a coating of magnesium oxide. Magnesium interacts with the air and moisture in the air very rapidly, and it produces magnesium oxide. And in here is the fresh magnesium. This is a coating of oxidation that is exactly like you would see on steel or aluminum. All of these metals oxidize. And if you think back to maybe like a Chem 1B lab or Chem 1A lab where you did redox chemistry and you were looking at the metal oxidation potentials, and when you worked with the metal, you needed to use a little bit of sandpaper or steel wool to remove the oxide coating off the metal in order to actually see the chemical reaction take place. You guys, I see some heads nodding in recollection. Same thing here. The magnesium, that magnesium oxide coating on this prevents the chemical reaction from taking place. Because remember that the chemical reaction that we're looking for is we're looking for this alkyl halide to react with magnesium in its zero oxidation state to make magnesium, which is in its 2+ state. And so if the magnesium that's here in the oxide is already in the 2+ state, then that magnesium oxide coating will prevent the chemical reaction from taking place, because you need magnesium that is in its zero oxidation state that has its two valence electrons in order to undergo this chemical reaction, because it is a redox reaction that is actually taking place in terms of this chemical reaction. So that magnesium oxide coating prevents that from happening. However, because we're using magnesium turnings and not ribbon, there's no easy way to polish or clean this magnesium ahead of time. And even if there was, it would react with oxygen so quickly that by the time you weighed it and got it back into the chemical reaction, it wouldn't work efficiently. So the mass would change and we wouldn't get a good reading on what the mass is. There's just all kinds of problems that brings up. So we don't worry about the magnesium oxide coating right now. We weigh the magnesium turnings, we throw them into the round bottom flask, and we get set up to go. The next thing that we do is we build a solution of bromobenzene in diethyl ether in the 5-mil conical vial. So we use the 5-mil conical vial . We tear the vial. We add approximately 0.70 milliliters of bromobenzene. Using a pipette, a calibrated pipette, and then we reweigh the vial to obtain the mass of the bromobenzene. Okay, why do we work from mass instead of volume? Volume is temperature dependent. Volume goes up and down with temperature because density is temperature dependent. And so as things expand and contract, as they heat and cool, the volume of a solution changes with temperature. So volume is always an approximation, and we should never do anything by volume if we're trying to do it stoichiometrically or we're trying to measure a yield on a chemical reaction. You should always do it by mass, because mass is independent of temperature. Mass is the same no matter what temperature the material is. So mass is constant. So the reason that we take and we use approximately 0.70 milliliters of bromobenzene is because that's going to give us approximately the right amount, but then we reweigh it to get the mass so that we know exactly how much we're using. And then we can calculate our stoichiometry, we can calculate our percent yields and everything from the actual mass that we obtain of that material. Okay, so it's really important that we do that. And then once we have reweighed this and we've got the mass, then we add 4.0 milliliters of anhydrous diethyl ether. And that makes a solution. The bromobenzene itself is too concentrated to add directly to the magnesium. We need a solvent in order to support everything. That solvent that we're going to use is diethyl ether. And rather than adding the bromobenzene to diethyl ether inside the round bottom flask, we make a solution of bromobenzene in diethyl ether so that we add that solution over time just to control the reaction and make this reaction a little bit easier to manage. So once we've made that solution, then what we're going to do, step seven here, is to use the syringe to add approximately 1 milliliter of the bromobenzene solution to the round bottom flask. And we do that through the rubber septa. On the Claisen. Okay, so that's set up. I'm gonna go back and grab our sort of setup that's here. So what we've got going on now is we have all of these little magnesium turnings that are in here with the spin vane. And we are going to take this conical vial and I'm going to put it over here next to the syringe. I didn't quite get the whole thing. because I'm going to grab the syringe and my conical vial and bring them all down here. So the idea here is that we've got the solution in the conical vial. We grab that solution out of the conical vial, and then we take and we insert the syringe into the rubber septa. And then we add about a mil of solvent to this so that the solvent just barely covers the magnesium tannins. And that's going to start off our solution and our reaction. So this now is our bromobenzene. Diethyl ether solution that is in there. And we'll keep this fairly well capped when we're not using it. Okay, now the problem of that oxide, how do we deal with that oxide? The oxide becomes a problem now because the reaction won't start with that magnesium oxide coating. So there are several different ways in order to initiate a Grignard reaction. One way that they say that works, I have never had this work, is they say they add a small amount of solid iodine. Add a crystal or two of solid iodine. The iodine is supposed to help catalyze the chemical reaction. In my early years when I started teaching at Cabrillo, I thought that was the best way to do it because that's what it said in the book. And I tried it. And it sucked, never worked. I don't think I ever saw it work once, never. The other way that's really good is to use a sonicator. Sonicator is like a jewelry cleaner where you would take and you would put your jewelry into this container that has water in it and then you turn it on and it does ultrasound. And it berates the metal with ultrasound, which blasts off all the dirt, grease, and oxide coating. And so a sonicator is a fantastic way to do this. However, we've got one sonicator and 21 students. So the sonicator is like not viable. The other way is to actually physically crush the magnesium as if you were to use a mortar and pestle and to crush the magnesium. And that's the way that I found that it introduces a small amount of water, but it's bulletproof and it works every single time. And so what I do is I have you guys then call me over once you've added this, this solution of bromobenzene, you call me over and I disassemble it for a second and I crush the magnesium using a glass stirring rod. And I actually take, what step are we on? 7, 8? Okay. So 8, you call me over. To crush the magnesium. And what I do is I take that round bottom off. And I take the lid off of it momentarily. And I use a glass stir rod. And that glass stir rod I have heated in the fire in a Bunsen burner. And I flattened the end of it to make sort of a good pestle-like. And I use it much like a mortar and pestle. I hold it in the palm of my hand and I push this down and I rotate it and I use it to just crush up some of the magnesium. And what winds up happening is those magnesium turnings, if we look at sort of like a large blow up of those magnesium turnings, what happens is they wind up getting crushed and broken and it reveals fresh magnesium on the inside. So it doesn't take all the coating off of it. What it really does is just magnesium as a metal is extraordinarily soft. You can almost cut it with a knife. And so when you smash those magnesium turnings, they break open on their seams, exposing the magnesium. And then the chemical reaction, once that magnesium is exposed, starts off, kicks off, and will eat out the inside of the magnesium, leaving the coating just on the outside. And we'll utilize almost all the magnesium at that point. And I can tell when I've done it enough, because the reaction goes from a clear, colorless reaction to start getting turbid. It starts to get cloudy. As soon as I see that little bit of turbidity, I know the reaction is going. I hook up the reaction back into its proper place. We start the spin vane and we allow the reaction to then go. And you can see that it just gets more and more turbid and darker over time as it goes. Oftentimes it'll turn a gray color. Sometimes it'll even turn a dark black color as the reaction is going. We see a lot of diversity in color at this point as the reaction proceeds. Okay, at this point, what we do is you are going to add the rest of the bromobenzene solution over a period of 15 minutes. Using the syringe. As an added note here, we add it at a rate that keeps the reaction below boiling. This reaction is exothermic. And the boiling point of diethyl ether is right around, I think it's 32 degrees Celsius, which means that you can almost boil diethyl ether by holding it in the palm of your hand. That particularly if your hands are really warm, you could cause the diethyl ether to almost boil in the palm of your hand. It doesn't take a whole lot of heat to boil diethyl ether. And we don't want to boil the diethyl ether off of this reaction. So because the reaction is exothermic, you add a small amount, you see the reaction start to boil, you stop adding. You let the reaction calm down. When the reaction stops boiling, you add a little bit more. When the reaction heats up and starts to boil, you stop and you let the reaction cool down. And you try to add the remaining bromobenzene solution over 15 minutes, being careful not to boil the reaction. So we add at a rate below boiling.
I have a question about that.
Yeah.
So do you have like a heat sink, or are you literally just waiting for it to dissipate in the air?
You're literally just waiting. We're using that hot plate only for stirring. We are not using any heat on the hot plate. The reaction is auto-catalyzing itself, and the heat from the reaction itself is causing the reaction to go forward and to keep going. But we just don't, if you add it too fast, you can cause the reaction to boil substantially, and you can lose a lot of diethyl ether because diethyl ether is just super volatile. So yeah, there's no heat sink. We just allow it to just cool down on its own, just in the air. Okay, at this point, after we have done this, you rinse the conical vial. With 2 milliliters of new clean diethyl ether. Let's do it this way. Instead of spelling out diethyl ether, let's use the abbreviation. And then we add that rinse. To the reaction. via syringe. Okay, now that we've rinsed that conical vial, we did that in order to police out all of the bromobenzene to make sure that 100% of the bromobenzene that we put into that vial gets added into the chemical reaction. So it's not sufficient to just add all of the original solution because there is still remnants on the sides of the flask when you're done. So we rinse that with 2 mL of diethyl ether and we add that into the chemical reaction, just making sure that we're policing and getting all of the solution and all of the bromobenzene into the round bottom. Now we use the same conical vial. We tear the vial and we add, what is it? 1.09 grams approximately, 1.09 grams of solid benzophenone. To the solid benzophenone, we add 2 mL of diethyl ether. And then we stir that to make a homogeneous solution. We then use the syringe to take up almost all of that benzophenone solution. To the round bottom flask. This is also very exothermic. We add it quickly. But at a rate below boiling. Now that the grignard has been made and we've made this benzophenone solution, when we add the benzophenone solution, it is the nucleophilic addition reaction which is taking place. We're making the new carbon-carbon bond at this point. So when we ended back here and we ended at this point, we ended at the point where we now in the round bottom have the grignard reagent. This is what's now in the round bottom. When we make this benzophenone solution and we add the benzophenone solution, the component of the reaction that we're doing is we're now taking our grignard that has been made and we are adding the benzophenone in diethyl ether and we are doing the addition reaction, making the new carbon-carbon bond. And the result at this point is to make what we call the adduct. This is the O minus, the magnesium 2 plus, and the bromide minus. And this thing is an alkoxide. And it is fully ionic. At this point, there's some really cool color changes that happen in the chemical reaction, but the reaction also starts to solidify because this component the adduct, what we call the adduct. An adduct is not your final product. An adduct is the bringing together of two molecules. So that's what the term adduct means, bringing together of two molecules. The adduct of bringing together the bromobenzene, it is phenylmagnesium bromide. And this is the benzophenone. The bringing together of that phenylmagnesium bromide Grignard reagent and the benzophenone results in an insoluble product. That insoluble product precipitates out and causes the entire reaction to solidify and gel. When the stirring starts to fail and the magnetic spin vane can no longer stir the chemical reaction, at that point, it is safe to open the reaction and to manipulate it and stir it physically by hand. So before we do that though and stir it by hand, what we typically do is we typically rinse the conical vial with 1 milliliter of diethyl ether and add that to the round bottom flask. And then when stirring fails, as the solid adduct forms, we open the round bottom and stir by hand. And we do that until the reaction takes on a homogeneous gray color. That is typically the end of the first day lab at the point where we make this adduct. At this point, the adduct is safe to store. It is no longer water sensitive. Water will no longer hurt the chemical reaction because the chemical reaction is essentially over. And at this point, we've done the chemical reaction and we start to proceed to the workup phase of the chemical reaction. And so all of this typically takes 3 hours from setup to running the reaction to cleanup. And we typically then cap these, store them in the locker until the next lab period. And then we come in the next lab period and we start the workup procedure. I'm wondering if, computer screens are freaking out. If I want to go into that, the workup isn't that bad. It does take a little bit more to explain. And we've still got a little more time. Let's go ahead.
What would you do, Jason, if you wanted to just keep your Grignard, like from the round bottom flask?
Oh, if you wanted to keep the Grignard reagent itself? Store the Grignard?
Yeah, if it's commercialized, you know.
Yeah, Grignards, there's very few that they actually sell as a Grignard product commercially. They do sell organometallics. You can buy alkyl lithiums. You can buy alkyl sodium reagents. You can buy Grignard reagents. You don't need to do anything special. Essentially, what happens is when they make a Grignard reagent like that, they would sell it in the same sort of container that they sell the diethyl ether in that's anhydrous. They sell it in a bottle that has the cap on it. Where did I draw that? Diethyl ether bottle. Must have been up higher. They sell it in a bottle that has a cap on it like this with a rubber septa. And they're typically refrigerated and shipped in a refrigerated container. So they ship it oftentimes with an ice pack that goes with it. And then when you use these, you don't take this bottle cap off ever. What you do is you do what's called air sensitive chemistry, where we use a syringe, much like we would have used, but with a very long needle called a cannula needle. And that long needle allows the needle to be able to go all the way down into the bottom of the container. And in order to remove components from this bottle, we have to have a second needle that goes in this that backfills with nitrogen. So as you draw out the liquid, you need the headspace to be backfilled with a gas, and we use an inert dry gas in order to do that. That is chemical techniques that are taught in grad school usually. I oftentimes teach them in the special projects that we have the ability to do that at Cabrillo. We have all of the air sensitive equipment. That was my primary training in grad school, was in air sensitive chemistry. And so I like to teach that component when I get the opportunities. And we have a Schlenk line all set up where we can transfer multiple different types of gases. We also have vacuum that we can pull through that Schlenk line. And it's all done through needles and long tubing. And it's a way of manipulating chemicals without ever introducing air or water. So yeah, that's how they would do it. They would do it in a bottle like this. They would transfer it with air sensitive techniques. Inside this, it would have a solution, and up here would be dry nitrogen gas. And they would ship it that way. And so it never gets water or moisture introduced to it.
Right. Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, good question. Okay. So we're at the end of this chemical reaction. We have produced this guy. We've produced this alkoxide ion. We store that in our locker until we come back. And then when we come back, we start the workup process. So this is technically the workup. We start by adding 6 mL of 6 molar hydrochloric acid. And we do that dropwise. This is important enough that I'm gonna like super highlight it. This thing is extremely exothermic. If you add the 6 moles or 6 milliliters all at once, you can cause the flask to boil over and to actually jettison the material that's in the flask. I have had students in the past think that the reaction is still air sensitive at the time that they're doing this step, throw in all of the 6 mils and then cap it. You know what that's called? When you take something that is extremely exothermic, throw in 6 mils of hydrochloric acid and then put a cap on it. It's not called a chemical reaction anymore. It's called a bomb. It's a mess, but yes, it's both a mess and a bomb. It exploded and the contents hit the ceiling, rained down over 2 students. So I had 6 mil hydrochloric acid rained down, plus all the contents of the Grignard and everything rained down over 2 students at the desktop. It took me 4 hours of cleaning, an hour of which was washing people's hair. And I pay extra for that. Or I charge extra for that. It took me hours to clean up from that episode and decontaminate everybody and get everybody new clothing and figure out how to deal with that whole thing. So, and the problem was is that the student was off to my left and had their back to me, and I couldn't see what they were doing. So it was at a point that was just at the initial start of the lab. I was just getting ready to walk around into police and sort of see that everybody was doing, and they had their back to me and I couldn't see what happened, and the whole thing just exploded. So we don't cap anything at this point. We're very careful to do this dropwise. It's extremely exothermic. And what you're doing is you're taking that adduct and you're protonating the alkoxide ion. And anytime you're doing an acid-base reaction like this, what you have is a base that is on par with hydroxide. And you are taking 6 molar hydrochloric acid. It's like as if you took concentrated hydroxide and added 6 molar hydrochloric acid to it. You can imagine that that would be extremely exothermic and would boil over. And essentially it does. And that's why we do it under controlled way and we add it dropwise. So this guy here, we are taking and adding HCl and we are producing the triphenylmethanol. And remember, it's still in diethyl ether. So the diethyl ether is still present. Even though the reaction looks like it's solid, it still has, what, 4 plus 2 plus 2, 8, 10. We've got 10 mils of diethyl ether that are in this round bottom still. And that's all still there. And you are creating magnesium salts, which are bromide and chloride, a mixed magnesium salt, which is forming. And the reaction goes biphasic at this point. So as this reaction is proceeding and you are adding these contents to the round bottom winds up getting multiple layers. And we see an aqueous layer at the top, aqueous layer at the bottom, organic layer at the top. And at the bottom, we have the aqueous layer. And what we want is we want for these two layers to be clear and colorless. Now there's a second reaction that's taking place while this is happening. Not only are we protonating the adduct, but there's still some magnesium that is left over from this chemical reaction that the magnesium is not fully reacted. So the magnesium is sitting in here and there's little bits of magnesium that are sitting at the interface. And that magnesium starts to react with the hydrochloric acid and it produces little bubbles. So we're getting little bubbles that are coming off of this. The reaction that is producing these bubbles is magnesium metal reacting with 2HCl to form magnesium chloride and H2. Hydrogen gas. So that's the other reaction that's actually taking place while this is going on. So the 6 molar hydrochloric acid has two things that it's doing. And the reason that we're using 6 molar hydrochloric acid rather than using a 1 molar or 0.5 molar is because we do want this reaction to take place as a way of getting rid of any unused magnesium to help in the isolation of the product that we're going after. So 6 molar is being used strategically in order to break down the magnesium metal and convert it into magnesium salts. So we need to be careful of that too. That is another reason why you don't cap this, because you're producing hydrogen gas, which is just more gas vapor to make a great bomb if you were to cap it. Okay, so once that is done, then we transfer all of this to a separatory funnel. And we do an extraction. Am I doing steps here? I am, yeah. So this is step number 2. transfer entire reaction. Contents to a separatory funnel. And extract the organic layer. Okay, what this looks like. In a separatory funnel, separatory funnels are a piece of glassware that are designed in a tapered shape. They have a ground glass stopcock, or sometimes a Teflon stopcock, and they have a pointed end or slanted end at the opening. And these guys are used with a ring stand and an actual ring that goes around these that they sit in. And what we typically do is use Erlenmeyer flasks that have a narrow opening. And we use or set up a height such that the separatory funnel actually sits inside the Erlenmeyer flask slightly. And inside of this, we have two different layers. We have an aqueous layer. We'll use a little bit of color to make it clear what layer is what. So there's our aqueous layer and our organic layer. And they are both clear and colorless. The only thing that you can see is the solvent line in between, the meniscus between the two. That's the only hint of where the layers are. So what we have is we have the aqueous layer and the organic layer. And in these two layers, what we have is we have diethyl ether that is in that organic layer. And in that organic layer is also the triphenyl methanol. And let's abbreviate triphenyl methanol PH3COH as an easy way to sort of abbreviate the triphenyl methanol. And in the aqueous layer, what we have is we have the HCl, we have the water, and we have the magnesium salts. Let's say MgX2, just to abbreviate all of those salts. And so what we're going to do is we're actually going to have two flasks, one for aqueous and one for organic. And we will draw down the aqueous into the first because that's what you pull out first. It's the only way that these work. And then we pull out the organic second, splitting them up. Okay, once we've done that, then what we do is we put the aqueous layer back into the separatory funnel and we do a second extraction. And we re-extract with 5 mL of diethyl ether. We combine the two organic layers. So initially what we did is we draw down the aqueous, switch flasks, put the organic flask on there, draw out the organic, take the aqueous, put the aqueous back into the separatory funnel, and then add 5 mL of clean diethyl ether that is coming out of the reagent bottle. we put the cap on this, we shake and vent in order to release the gases. Once we've shaken it for about 5 minutes in order to get good extraction between the organic and aqueous layers, we take the top off of it. We drain out the aqueous into this aqueous container. It can still go back in here. And then we take the organic layer, the diethyl ether layer, and we combine it with the first one such that we initially had about 10 mils of organic. Now, when we're done, we should have about 15 mils because we've re-extracted. And so now we should be at approximately 15 milliliters of organic. Now, we're going to have to get the water out of this. And I don't know if Zaruba has talked to you about doing extractions in Chem 12A. You should have talked about extractions and the need to be able to dry these reagents before you move to actually removing the solvent. Because right now there's water that's in here. Diethyl ether is extremely hygroscopic. It sucks up water because of its ability to hydrogen bond. And so we're going to do two drying steps now in order to get all the water out of this. We're going to do number four. This is a pre-drying step. What we do is we put the diethyl ether back into the separatory funnel. And we'll call this a wash step and wash with 5 milliliters of what is called a brine solution. A brine solution brine is saturated aqueous sodium chloride. We basically just dissolve sodium chloride into water until it won't take any more. That's what we call a brine solution. Just like you would call a pickling solution a brine solution. It's a salt solution. That saturated sodium chloride, we add into the SEP funnel. And what it does is through osmotic pressure, having all those dissolved salts in the water causes any aqueous solution that is in the diethyl ether to migrate into the aqueous phase, trying to dilute down the sodium chloride. So the sodium chloride is literally drawing the water out of the diethyl ether as a pre-drying step. So that guy, if we take this SEP funnel and we take this whole setup, what we do here is we add in the brine. This is now saturated sodium chloride. And what winds up happening is between these two layers, because there is so much salt dissolved in the saturated sodium chloride and the diethyl ether layer, which is sitting up here that has some water in it, the water migrates to this side in order to try to dilute down the salt through osmotic pressure. And it serves as a pre-drying step. And so then we go through and we do the extraction and we basically get this aqueous layer, which is now our brine and salts, and the organic, which is now drier. It's still not totally dry. We have one more drying step that we need to do on it. Now what we do is we dry this let's say, dry the diethyl ether with magnesium sulfate solid. Magnesium sulfate is a drying agent of choice that, when anhydrous and added to water, produces a solid magnesium sulfate heptahydrate. And so we add magnesium sulfate to that Erlenmeyer flask. And I like to call it that I'm looking for sort of a snow globe effect. That I add enough of this magnesium sulfate that it can kick up a little bit and make a little bit of dust into this solution. And the reason that is because this is a sticky solid and magnesium sulfate is a powdery solid. And so when it becomes sticky in clumps, you know that you've absorbed water. But if you have free flowing powder, you know that there's no more water in the container. And so you add this material until you start to see a little bit of free flowing powder so that when you swirl it, it kicks up like a snow globe. If you imagine a snow globe, like one of those Christmas ornament type things that you shake and you have all the little white beads flowing in like snow, that's the kind of effect that you want to see, is you want to see sort of that snow globe or snowy effect when you swirl it. That's when you know that this has been dry enough. And then from there, what we do, after we've let it sit for about 5 minutes, we decant it into a round bottom and then we rotovap it. Okay, so the rotovap, I'm not going to draw the whole rotovap. Maybe I'll do that at another time and we'll talk about how the rotovap works. But essentially what the rotovap does is it removes the solvent. And after removing the solvent, what we get is a solid sort of goo material that comes out of this. And that solid goo material, we then take and we do what's called a trituration. Triturate solid residue with, how much do I use? 3 milliliters petroleum ether. Okay, what is a trituration? And what is in this solid mix? In the solid mix, the solid contains the crude product that we want, triphenyl methanol, so that's in there. The solid also contains a little bit of benzophenone. So that's in there. If there was any water in the chemical reaction, and it's likely that a little bit of water got into our chemical reaction, there's some benzene that's in there from the Grignard reaction working as a base to pick up a proton. So it picked up that proton and it made benzene from water. That's from the acid-base reaction. There could be a little bit of our starting material that is the bromobenzene. And then there's one other product that finds its way into this. And this is a side product that we'll have to talk about where this comes from. This is called biphenyl. And it is a side product of the Grignard reacting with bromobenzene, that the Grignard reacts with the starting material to make this material, which is called biphenyl. So all of these things are in that solid. And when we triturate it with petroleum ether is an interesting material. It's not an ether at all. Petroleum ether is a mixture of C4 to like C6 hydrocarbons. It's a mixture like kerosene or gasoline. It's a boiling fraction. It boils from about 32 to 34 degrees Celsius. And it is probably a mixture of maybe 6 different isomers of hydrocarbons, all nonpolar. So there is no oxygen in this material at all. This material is completely nonpolar. And so what winds up happening is when we put petroleum ether into this, the petroleum ether takes all of these materials and it sets up, this is the way that we would draw it in a separation scheme. It sets up a difference where things are still solid and things are in liquid solution. So the petroleum ether, which is nonpolar, dissolves all of the nonpolar things. It dissolves the benzene. It dissolves the biphenyl. It dissolves the benzophenone, which is mostly nonpolar. It dissolves any bromobenzene that was still in that solution. So it's dissolving everything except the more polar alcohol, triphenylmethanol. And the triphenylmethanol remains as a solid. So this word trituration is just a fancy word to say that we throw in a solvent and we mix it up and then we filter it. That's what a trituration is. It means to mix a solid with a solvent in order to extract out byproducts. So that was step 7. I'll zoom out so you guys can kind of see that slide still. Step 8 is to filter on a Hirsch funnel. We weigh the solid. Anytime you get a solid, you should weigh it. And then we do a recrystallization from isopropanol. Now the recrystallization is a whole process in and of itself that has its own procedure. And hopefully Zaruba had sort of given you an idea of how recrystallizations work last semester. We'll have it all on the video and I'll show you guys exactly how we go through and do that all too and break that down. But after we recrystallize it, then the last step that we do is we take melting points. We take a solid FTIR. We get a final mass. And we calc the percent yield. And that would be all of our final data that we go through and accumulate. And that percent yield, we'll talk about in the next lab when we get back together again. We'll talk about how we work all this up. And I'll go through a full separation scheme and show you where everything went and how it all broke down through this. And hopefully before that happens, I will have had the video up and you guys could have watched the lab and actually seen all of this take place. But that's the whole process. So this actually is, would take two lab periods to go through and do. By the time you go through and do this isolation, recrystallization, and then getting the IR, sometimes it even takes 3 days because we're still finishing up melting points in IR in order to be able to go through and do this.
What do you mean by FTIR?
Did you guys talk about the IR instrument and how to do IR spectroscopy? So
yeah.
Okay, FTIR is Fourier Transform IR. It's the same, it's the type of IR instrument that we have. Our instrument is a Fourier Transform IR. It is a very expensive research grade instrument. And it works. If you remember how IR works, you're shining infrared light on a sample and you're looking to see where that sample absorbs the infrared light, what bands of light it's absorbing. And it's absorbing those bands based on the types of vibrational frequencies that are within the molecule. So you have vibrational stretching, you have twisting, you have all different types of absorption modes that a molecule can have. And what an FTIR does is it shines that light on the molecule, and then it has another band of light that goes around the molecule that goes through a pair of mirrors. The two forms of light then go through an interferometer, and the interferometer measures the interference pattern between the two bands of light that creates a beat pattern. And then that Fourier transform mathematical process is done to produce a line spectrum to show you where the absorptions are actually occurring. So Fourier transform is a mathematical process that takes cyclical information and converts it into line spectrum. It's the mathematical operation that does that. So that's where the FT in that name comes from. But it essentially is nothing more than just doing IR spectroscopy. Okay, long explanation for an easy question, probably.
It's a great answer.
Yeah, okay. We've been going for about an hour and 45 minutes. And I want to be, this is probably as long as I ever want to lecture in a Zoom format, because I know that we all get Zoom fatigue. If there's any questions, I'm happy to entertain them. Otherwise, I think this is a good spot to cut it and just cut it a little bit early. And then I'll be back online in another 15 minutes at 11 o'clock for office hours. And then we'll pick it up with lecture at 12:40. Does that sound like a plan? See, my tongue stops working too. Does that sound like a plan? Are we in good shape here? Okay, any questions on what we covered? If there are, you're welcome to hang around and I'll answer anything that seems to be, you know, if you have any of those questions that you don't want to throw out in the normal scope of class, I'll hang around for a few minutes and entertain all of those crazy questions that you might have, okay? And other than that, I'll see you guys a little bit later.
Thanks, Jason.
All right, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.